My guest last hour and through the remainder of this hour, Bill Burns, as we discuss all things UFO. We've been discussing disclosure. We've discussed what's gone on with Podesta's claims, what a lot of the president's stances have been, including the recent little interview that Jimmy Kimmel just did last Friday with President Barack Obama. In the next hour, I do want to talk about Roswell, the slides that have supposedly shown up. Roswell slides found in an attic that were supposed to be revealed and really inspected, reportedly authenticated by experts. The slides are set to be unveiled and be shown worldwide. I want to get my guests' take on these slides. They supposedly date to the exact time of the crash. They're Kodachrome film slides. They've been developed the classic way. But does that mean they're authentic and that they were taken in 1947? Or is this something that has also been faked? Is this going to turn out to be another alien autopsy video that later on we find is another faked piece of information? We'll talk with Bill Burns about that. Hey, have you stopped by the Coast to Coast AM website recently and seen all of the amazing new updates? Well, you should go check it out. And while you're there, become a Coast Insider. What's a Coast Insider? It's how you can keep up with all the best of Coast to Coast AM. You can find news there. You can find live chats with the hosts of Coast to Coast and some of the amazing guests. You can also find archives going back 5 years right on the site. And you can do it all for only 15 cents a day. Check out the Coast to Coast Insider. And while you're checking out the website, make sure to check out Beyond Belief as well. That's George Norrie's internet TV show, Beyond Belief. And you can check more information about that on beyondbelief.com. I'm your host this evening, Dave Schrader, Alien Disclosure, UFOs, and more when we return to Coast AM. Phone lines are open. We'll begin taking your calls in just a few moments. Bill Burns, our guest this evening. Bill, what do you make of these slides? Is it possible that there are still pieces of evidence floating around about Roswell that have not been scooped up, have not been picked up, and we may actually get information from?
Yeah, I think that I think that's a true statement, that there are pieces probably floating around, probably at Wright Field, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, places like that, where some of the debris has been kept. I really focus my attention on the one slide that's not blurry. Obviously, the two slides that turned up, I have a bunch of questions. I'm not willing to jump into it and, you know, like pronounce them real. But the things that bother me about it is, well, the one thing that bothers me about it primarily is, why is that slide or those two slides in that collection of other slides?
Well, can you give us a little update for listeners that may not be familiar with what we're speaking about? Tell us a little bit about the Roswell slides, how they were found, and what's going on with these.
Yeah, these were slides found in an attic. I forget the name of the people who owned them. They're both deceased. But this person was a geologist working for one of the major oil companies. This was in Midland, Texas. And he was working for the major oil companies. This was a very well-connected couple. There are photos of Eisenhower circa 1947, 1948, obviously before he became president in 1953. And they were obviously very well-connected individuals. They were world travelers. So these really are travel slides for the most part. Different countries, different places they've been. And so that really is the essence of these slides. They're not about UFOs. They're not about Roswell. They're not about flying saucers. They're about a couple that traveled around the world, traveled around the country, and were influential people in so far as the connections they had, especially knowing Dwight D. Eisenhower between World War II and the Korean War. So that's the essence of these slides. They were found in an attic. And the person who was now representing it is kind of a sports guy. And to his credit, he did try to establish the provenance of these slides. They date from when they're supposed to be dated, 1947, 1948. Kodachrome was a company back then. They did have slides back then. So at least the dating portion seems real. My problem with the the one slide that's clear. It's of an alien, this enlarged alien head. It's a very articulated head, large eyes, exactly as an entity has been described by Betty Hill and by other abductees and by other witnesses, but it's articulated. The thing that bothers me about it is it's so out of place in this collection. So is the other slide, which is very blurry, tough to see. But this is very out of place. These are travel slides. Why is a slide ostensibly taken of an alien lying in a glass container on a shelf in that collection with the other Kodachrome slides? So that's one problem for me.
Well, A, couldn't it be if you had access to that, you may not have a lot of time to fire off a picture. Maybe you crack off one or two or three if you can. Two of them might be blurry. The third one might be clear. I could understand why that might be random. Maybe it was something they didn't expect or were, you know, kind of surprised to actually be given access to. So that part I could follow why they might be randomly put in here. Or maybe they were hidden in plain sight with these other slides, thinking that nobody would be looking just among their regular travel slides for these particular pieces.
Right. That all makes sense. Certainly. But anyway, so that's one of my concerns. But your argument does make sense that what a great place to bury a slide you're not supposed to have than to stick it in plain sight with travel slides, thinking nobody will ever know it's there. And sure enough, it's discovered after you're dead and nobody can blame you for it. So that's one. The other problem, which is larger for me, is that that one slide doesn't comport with the physical descriptions of these entities that were made by eyewitnesses whom I trust. So I keep thinking of this one person who was a maintenance man at the 509th, and he described the entity that he saw being brought back to the base on a stretcher. It was dying, and he said it looked to him like this is an insect in the Southwest called Child of the Desert. And I've actually seen this insect. It was when we were living in Los Angeles, this thing was hiding beneath the curtains. It almost scared me half to death because it's large. And it has what amounts to basically a human face on an insect body. It's a weird, weird insect. And that was one description. The other description came from another person whose story I trust. Again, this comes from his children. His name was Marion Magruder. He was Lieutenant Colonel Marion Magruder, who was at the National Air War College in 1948. And this class was taken to Wright Field before it became Wright-Patterson, where he told his children he saw the alien, the ET, the EBE. He saw this thing. It was behind glass. And he gave a very distinctive description. And his description was, and it struck me, this thing looked more human than not. But where it did not look human, that was what was most disturbing about it. In other words, it looked human, but you knew that it wasn't because of some strange anomalies. One of them was the long, wavy aspect of how it moved. He called it squiggly. It said it had spaghetti arms. But he did say that the head was only slightly larger than a human head. It was not a big light bulb kind of thing. It was slightly larger than a human head. And he said it looked more human than not, except the mouth was a slit. He didn't see any ears, and its eyes were very large. This slide didn't look like that. And that's what bothered me about this slide.
Well, now it could be said as well why, and you know this as somebody who studies crime and criminal work, a lot of why personal eyewitnesses are so easily discounted. Sometimes they see something at such a fleeting moment they didn't drink in. They thought they saw what they saw, and it turns out that who they believed was the criminal really wasn't, and it was such a dramatic change from who the actual person is that they caught red-handed later. You have these eyewitness accounts that don't always mesh up.
That's true.
That might be what occurred at that time, and it was such a holy cow moment for these people, that they were taking in everything that they were seeing, and they were looking at these creatures, looking at a craft, looking at the military, you know, whatever was going on at the time.
Right, and I would agree with that wholeheartedly, but for the fact that Magruder, Marion Magruder, his class actually was sent to Wright Field for the specific, there was a specific purpose. And the purpose was, these were off Air Force and Army Air Force and Air Force and Navy and Marine pilots. They were in training to become senior officers, command officers. Mm-hmm. And the purpose was to develop a strategy. And this is what I found so fascinating about that, that the government circa 1947-48 really didn't have a strategy about this. They just had this event, and they had to figure out what it was. And they had other sightings, like the Kenneth Arnold sighting, they had to figure out what it was. And so this air war class was sent to Wright Field for the express purpose of coming up with some sort of policy. So this encounter that Marion Magruder told his children that he had wasn't simply a fleeting encounter. This was an absolute inspection. He inspected the debris from the Roswell debris field. He saw the artifacts. His description of things like the I-beam and the strange graphics on it comported exactly with what Jesse Marcel Jr. said his father brought home on his way back from the debris field to Walker Army Airfield.
So, let me ask you one more thing about the authenticity of the slides. Now, I know that there are still places, there are stores that they're finding and locations that they're still opening up, that they find old stores with original stock, mm-hmm. everything from old Burma Shave to film, and on eBay and places like that. Couldn't it be said, if I found old slide stock from the 40s, and I took it into an older camera, took some photographs with it, and knew what I was doing in developing, and I know that what they did was they tested, okay, this is definitely stock from that time, and that right. It was developed in the way that it was developed back in the 1940s. It's using the correct chemicals and things like that. But as a photography student, couldn't it be faked and use those chemicals today to give some sort of authenticity? Do you look at it, and I know you're skeptical of a lot of these claims that come through as well. Is that a possibility, or are the chemicals that they say were used are just totally unavailable to the public in any way, shape, or form at this point?
Well, I don't know about today's availability of those chemicals, and I don't know that let's just say that slide's a hoax, just for the sake of immediate argument.
Right.
That could have been hoaxed at any time. It could have been hoaxed in the 60s, could mm-hmm. have been hoaxed in the 70s. So whether the chemicals are available today, I think they are. Those particular chemicals. I mean, I used to have my own little dark room and enlarger and stuff back in the 50s, in the 1950s, and I just remember those chemicals were readily available. You can get them anywhere, at any photo store. You could buy them from Kodak. You possibly still can. So they could be readily available. And yes, if you were a good photographer, and you knew your stock, and you knew your chemicals, I think it is quite possible you could have hoaxed something like that using original materials and original methods of developing those materials, but have taken that particular photograph of that particular head.
So at this point, are you on the side of skepticism that this is probably a faked slide or photograph?
Yes.
All right. Good,
I'm on the
good
side
to know.
Of skepticism. I'm not demolishing the photograph. I'm saying I have yet to be convinced that it's real.
Let's start taking some phone calls. We'll go west of the Rockies. Francine in Los Angeles. Welcome to Coast to Coast AM.
Hi, Dave. Hi, Bill. Thank you for taking my call. Bill, I've been wanting to speak to you for some time about an event that happened that I actually know the person. It's not like a friend of a friend of a friend. I worked with someone in the late 80s, early 90s, who had twin sons. They took two boats over to Catalina, you know, from Southern California, yeah. That 26 mm-hmm. miles across. It was yep. an absolutely perfect, idyllic day. One was in front of the other. They were twin boys, real good-looking guys. The one brother yelled to the brother and pointed off to something to the right of their boat. Well, the brother who was in front, you know, waved back and just kept going. Well, what happened was the other brother turned and made a right. He literally disappeared off of the face of the water. There were no storms. There was nothing that they knew he could have hit. And they never found anything from his disappearance. I asked David Pilates, and apparently there are cases now where people are having these same kind of strange abductions, but they're happening in water. Can you give us some insight as to what might be going on in that California corridor that could have, I think he was taken. And anyway, have a good night, and thank you for your time.
Sure.
Thank
well,
you for calling
I have heard stories about that. In fact, when we did UFO Hunters, we were out in that particular channel, the channel between Long Beach and Santa Catalina. And in fact, we heard stories from eyewitnesses about craft coming out of the water. In fact, one of the stories, the people who told me a story about this was Los Angeles County Sheriff Lee Baca, who, when he saw a copy of UFO magazine, we were having lunch, and he looked it down and said, "There is more to this story than meets the eye." And when you look at, when you listen to some of the 911 calls from the Lost Hills Sheriff Station in Malibu, again, overlooking Santa Monica Bay, you hear stories of people talking about craft coming in and out of the water. One of the most poignant stories to me, which is pertinent to the story we just heard about something in the water and somebody just disappearing, was from a private detective, Noah Felice, who was a guest on our show, who's still a friend of mine. And he said that when he was flying his own private plane with his cousin, he saw a bright light, an object that was illuminated under the surface of the water. This is right off Catalina. And he said he turned his plane around, banked it, and went down to get a closer look at this thing, because it was not a boat and it was not a submarine. Didn't know what it was. And he lowered his plane, dropped down close to water level to get a better look. Suddenly, he said his plane was hit with a light, and he called it a fluid light. And he said he felt as if he were floating in the fluid. He had no control over his private plane, none whatsoever. And then he was hit with another light, and he said he felt like he was being moved out of the plane. And the next thing he knew was that he was 6 years old again with the passenger in the plane, his cousin, who'd been diagnosed with terminal cancer, and they were playing as if they were 6 years old again. It was a memory, but it was a living memory, as if he were really there. Then he was being pulled out of the water by Baywatch, who said he'd been in the water for 20 minutes. In the water for 20 minutes, yet he was still alive. His cousin had died. And in fact, he said he was actually told in this kind of a dream state that he was not going to die. He was going back, but his cousin was coming with them. And he said to this very, this was, you know, decades ago, to this very day, he said that story remains with him, and it changed him as a human being, because he now says he gets messages from whomever they were.
Bill Burns, our guest, will continue taking your calls. We've got more questions, more emails coming in as well. If you have a question for our guest, you can always email me at dave@darknessradio.com. That's dave@darknessradio.com. Stay tuned. We'll be back with more of Coast to Coast AM. For the remainder of this hour, we will continue taking your phone calls for questions for our guest, Bill Burns. The top of next hour, we'll be joined by Nigel Watson. His book, UFOs of the First World War, will discuss some very strange sightings and encounters that took place during World War I. And we'll also open up phone lines in the fourth hour for you if you have questions with our guest at that time. If you've missed any part of tonight's show, don't fret. It's so simple to get back into it. Just go check out coasttocoastam.com and become a Coast Insider for 15 cents a day. It's that simple. 5 years of past archives, live chats with the hosts and guests of Coast to Coast AM, great news. Plus, go check out the website for all of the new updates. That's at coasttocoastam.com. Stay tuned. We'll be back with more Bill Burns right here on Coast to Coast AM. This is Coast to Coast AM. I'm your host this evening, Dave Schrader, my guest, Bill Burns, and we're taking your calls. Wildcard Line 1, Jan in Brooklyn, welcome to the show. Jan, are you with us? All right, let's go to what? Oh, are you there, Jan?
I'm here.
Okay, Jan, thanks a lot. What's your question for Bill?
I have two questions. He just mentioned about the guy with 20 minutes in the water that he said they're contacting him. I want to know what they're telling him. And my second question is, of course, the aliens don't want to be announced. If they go and they take people to experiment on, you know, they don't want people knowing about that.
Well, that's true. I mean, at least to your second point, that if they're collecting our DNA for some reason, you could speculate about that. But if they're collecting our DNA, then why would the government admit to the fact that they are allowing entities to basically collect some biological specimens from this planet, our DNA, with impunity? So I think that would be part of, if there's a conspiracy cover-up, then indeed that's part of it. The kind of things that Noah Felice is being told about by the entities that took him, and I believe his story, that took him, are, it's almost as though, and I've heard this from other people as well, he developed a kind of a sensory power, a sensory ability that he didn't have before the crash of his airplane. Travis Walton has told me the same thing about his experience on board that craft, that somehow neurologically he was transformed, so he's getting some kind of messages. What the messages are, basically they're warnings. Edgar Mitchell told me the same thing this morning, that they are warnings about the sustainability of the human race on this planet. Whether we're looking at an extinction event, I don't think it's an end times thing, but whether we're looking at an extinction event or whether we're looking at our causing the very conditions, such as overpopulation, nuclear waste, climate change, things like that, that will impact us. So that's the kind of stuff that Noah's been hearing through his dreams, let's say, through his lucid dreams from these creatures.
Bill, I've got an email here. It says, hello, Dave and Bill. I'm wondering if either one of you remembers a news story from the mid-1980s claiming that a wave from deep in space was headed for Earth. The news story ran twice about 6 months apart on the TV station in Boston, Massachusetts, hosted by Natalie Jacobson as a public service announcement style piece, saying that this type of wave had never been experienced before, so they didn't know what would happen. The story also claimed that people should lay down motionless during the time the wave would pass, if I could remember correctly, at about 9 p.m. The reason I ask is the story may be related to some type of energy-based transportation or communication system with unknown alien life forms, and that comes from Jim.
I remember a story about that back in the 1980s. I never followed it up. It seemed to just disappear.
Well, that's a very bizarre kind of story to come out. I mean, just and nobody ever follows up on that. Do we get things? I mean, I remember too, and maybe you can help me if this was a hoax at the time. I was young, it was the 70s, and I thought I remembered hearing something about along Florida's coast, radio station signals were taken over by some kind of message that claimed to be alien in nature that was going to broadcast some kind of message. Do you remember anything about that, Bill?
I heard that story, too. I mean, back in the 70s, I was still teaching at Trenton State College. I wasn't really involved in anything paranormal. But I just remember there was a buzz about this thing about some strange radio transmission. And that's really all I remember about it. In terms of the wave, we routinely get waves of solar ejections, of coronal ejections from the sun. We routinely get those. And sometimes the warnings about the energy, about the gamma rays in these, that literally can strip away parts of our ozone and make their ways through the magnetosphere in such a way as to disrupt communications. I don't remember anything so serious that you didn't have phone contact or you didn't have internet contact, but we routinely get these kinds of waves of energy, at least coming from the sun.
All right, and let's go to wild card line two, Greg in Jacksonville, Florida. You're on Coast to Coast AM.
Good morning, gentlemen. Good morning, world. Well,
good morning.
Earlier, Super Dave asked you a question I don't think you fully understood, so I'm going to ask it again. If there is a no ask, no tell policy, what is the difference between these creatures blatantly showing themselves in a craft, clearly seen and visible, you know, by the masses? What is the difference between that and landing on the ground and saying, here we are?
I think it is the fact that you could always find someone to deny a UFO sighting. It is one of our own planes. It is a secret craft. The people seeing it are not sure of what they're seeing. You could
That's true.
Find people that, if necessary, will claim to have hoaxed that UFO sighting. But for a craft to land on the ground and for some entity to walk outside that craft and make that entity known to human beings, that's a totally different thing. So, for example, you take the Phoenix Lights, right, the 1997 Phoenix Lights.
Mm-hmm.
People saw these things. They were captured on film. There were the 830 lights. There were the 1030 lights. Along comes the Maryland Air National Guard to say, oh, no, there were no lights. These were flares. It was our exercise, Operation Snowbird or something, over the Barry Goldwater test range. Look at the Hudson Valley sightings from the from the late 80s, early 90s. After people saw these things in New York, in Connecticut, over the Indian Point power plant, a group of flyers calling them, I forget, the Storm Kings or the Storm Flyers or something, said, oh, no, it was really us. We were the ones flying in tight formation to hoax this. Now, it certainly wasn't them, because the planes they were flying would have been very, very loud at that speed and at that altitude. But that's what they claimed, and people bought it. People bought the flares story. Of course, nobody ever commented on the 830 lights over Phoenix, except for Fife Symington, who said he saw that was a UFO. But people commented on the 1030 lights, and that has washed away. So it is plausible for individuals, debunkers, to give conventional explanations for anomalous sightings. I remember when we were covering the Tinley lights, the Tinley Park lights over Illinois, huge objects floating across the sky. Police saw these things. Local people saw these things. Folks coming out of an Ozzy Osbourne concert saw these things. And yet, I got horrendous emails. I mean, furious emails telling me flat out, don't you know that what these folks were all seeing was the constellation Cassiopeia moving across the sky? Well, A, Cassiopeia doesn't move across the sky. It's a constellation. So, and B, you wouldn't see it move across the sky. And C, it wouldn't stop dead in the air and hover. Yet that was the explanation that I got, with somebody sending me photographs that looked like the formations that people had videotaped from their camcorders, from their backyards.
Let's go east.
I appreciate you, gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
You.
Let's go east of the Rockies. Rick in Omaha, Nebraska. You're on Coast to Coast AM.
Good evening, gentlemen. This is Admiral Dobson calling from Omaha, Nebraska. First, I would like to make a comment to Dave before I make my question to Bill. You had a question about the waves the article on the space waves.
Yes.
That was an article. The U.S. Air Force was doing some research. They were, had a satellite they were going to put up to detect gravity waves that come through space. So that's what that article was about, just so that you know.
All right, thank you.
Bill, what I would like to do is kind of disclosure. When I was in the military, of course, my security clearances, you know, you've spoken to many people in the military, we tread very lightly. You don't want to get a bullet in the back of the head. If you break your security clearances, that's what happens. And everybody knows it. That's why they don't talk. But the information that I'm going to say, you know, I'm now no longer active duty. My clearances are now clear. And the information that I'm about to give to you came personally from me and not through my duties in the military. 16 years in military aviation and 10 years in civilian aviation. So the information I'm about ready to give to you is the real deal. I don't know if you've heard it. I'm very amazed because the information that has come across my desk as a chairman and CEO of the International Space Agency, and I keep most of my information classified too, so that I can verify my sources. But I'm very amazed. In 1986, I was sitting on a dock because I lived right on the ocean in Virginia Beach, Virginia. It was about 2 o'clock in the evening. I used to go down, you know, military duty is hard, so, you know, when I get home at night, I would go out on the dock and just sit there and just look up at the stars and just relax. But one night, this craft, about 40 feet or so in diameter, came and hovered over my head. Now, it was a perfect sphere, and it had this corona around it. If you've ever seen an arc welder, when somebody's using an arc welder, this was a blue corona all around the vehicle. Now, it sat there and hovered over me for 4 minutes. Now, I never told anybody, because I was in the military and I knew better than do that. My landlady, who lived also at the same address because I rented when I was in the Navy, the back of basically a mansion. I mean, I lived in a very wealthy community at the time, and I told her about this blue sphere, and she said, don't worry about it. We see them all the time, and there's, you know, they won't harm you or anything. So over the years, I saw these spherical craft on a number of occasions. Now, 5 months ago, I moved from a place called Ogallala, Nebraska, to an undisclosed location. I will not give out my location at the present time because I get death threats on a regular basis because of my work with the International Space Agency. But in Ogallala, Nebraska, while I was moving, one of my friends who's a lieutenant in the Coast Guard there and also works for Homeland Security was with me and one of my neighbors, and we were packing up for my move. Now, my friend who was in the Coast Guard got oddly sick, and he said, you know, I just all of a sudden got sick. I got to go. Well, he pulls out of my driveway, and he hadn't pulled out of my driveway more than, I'd say, 2 minutes. These three red spheres, almost exactly the same ship that I saw in Virginia Beach, Virginia, except this time they had red coronas around them. There was three of them. There was two of them that were at a, you know, at a higher altitude, I would say about 800 feet. And the third of the ships was directly below the two that were at the upper altitude. And it was, I'd say, 80 feet over the treetops. And me and my neighbor were sitting out on the front of my house, and these three vehicles came towards us from the far distance, almost like out of Star Trek. You know, you see the Enterprise and it's gone. Well, these spheres came right at us at high speed. Now, my aviation career, I would say that these vehicles were moving in excess of, you know, multiple Machs, Mach 5 or 6. I mean, they spanned hundreds of miles in just a few seconds. Now, all three of these vehicles came to a complete stop over my house. Now, my neighbor, the lower vehicle, the lower of the three, the orangish-red arc off the outside of the vehicle, this vehicle was only about 80 feet off the ground. You could have picked up a rock and hit it. And it lit up all the tops of the trees, all the tops of the houses. My neighbor, he was absolutely freaked. I saw, I thought he was going to go crazy, nuts. He ran across, he tripped over my stone fence in the front of my house, ran out in the middle of the road, right underneath the one vehicle. And they sat there and hovered over my house for, I'd say, a good 2 or 3 minutes. The two that were at the upper altitude sat there and made a 360-degree orbit. And the one that was at the lower, over the treetops, just sat there at a hover. Now, had anybody been outside, I mean, this is like 10 o'clock in the evening in Ogallala, Nebraska. It lit up all the tops of the houses. I mean, you couldn't miss it. If anybody was standing outside, they had to have seen it. Now, these vehicles, the one that was low over the treetops, after it sat there for about a minute over my house, it shot straight up to the other two, and then they headed off towards the Ogallala Lake, which is a major resort lake. And when they took off again, I mean, these vehicles took off like in Star Trek. They were gone, off in the distance, you know, traveling hundreds of miles in mere seconds. Now, I've seen these vehicles before, and
We've got about a minute left with you, Rick. I'm just giving you the heads up before we go to the top of the hour break and our other guests. So if you've got a point that you want to get to directly, let's hit it. Yep.
Okay. I went to YouTube and put in red spheres in the sky with my neighbor there. And I was absolutely stunned to find out over every major city in the United States this year, or actually last year now, that this exact same formation of the two ships with the one below it, I saw hundreds and hundreds of videos of the same exact vehicles that came and hovered over my house. And I'm just amazed that after I saw how many of these videos are out there, that this isn't being, I have heard nothing anywhere in the media. I haven't heard it in the, you know, on coast to coast. And then the other thing is about 4 days after we saw these vehicles, there was a report of a 747 flying over the Atlantic Ocean that saw tens of thousands of these red orbs underneath the ocean. And then I haven't heard anything about the report since.
Well, thank you. Thank you for calling in, Rick. Really quickly, Bill, we've got less than a minute. What do you know of these stories, and is there any legitimacy
to this? I know that these stories have been all over the place. Folks interested in finding out more about these, thank you, caller. Thank you, Rick. Look up on the internet this person called Terry Ray, R-A-Y, Terry Ray. He's Pennsylvania MUFON. He has done a study of the occurrences of these orbs. He's seen them himself. He was former military, just like Rick. He's seen them himself over his house. He's plotted them. He's shown what their trajectories are, when they turn up, and he thinks he knows why they turn up. So red orbs, orange orbs. Terry Ray, he's MUFON, Pennsylvania. He wrote a whole book about it. He'll send you the book.
Great. Thank you very much, Bill Burns, our guest. I appreciate talking to you as always, Bill. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll explore the phenomena of UFOs during World War I at the infancy of our flight. Could there have been alien craft in the sky along with us? Nigel Watson reports on that next here on Coast to Coast AM.